In regard to the shuttle program, because there, of course, the experiment situation will be quite different. In fact, the shuttle is the same and will stay the same, maybe with the exception of a few minor improvements that still may be introduced during the program, possibly in life support systems and other auxiliary systems. I hope we don't have to change the main shuttle itself. But the experiments, of course, will be a continuing situation where you have a new set of experiments all the time. And then some of these things you just mentioned are, of course, really the nucleus of the problem. What do you think, and maybe you have not really had a chance to think about this kind of program too much?
No, I really haven't. My only thought about them, that one is that, again, relating back to Apollo and even more to Skylab, we learned that you can work in a large variety of ways with experimenters. And if you think about it for a moment, we had government-to-government interfaces, in which Marshall Space Flight Center, as an example, was an experiment development center. And Marshall came down here with their people, and we worked with them, and just had a fine arrangement working directly with the Marshall people on experiments. We had other cases where we worked directly with contractors, or other government research laboratories. Some of these arrangements were very informal. Others, we had contracts directly with the experimenter. In other cases, the contractor had a contract with a development center, let's say JSC, and we had a delegation from JSC to supervise their work down here. The point of all this is that you can work out any kind of arrangement you want, as long as the parties agree, you write it down in some minimum amount of formality so you understand what you're doing. And the experiment work and the experiment world, I believe, has to be flexible like that. If you get yourself fixed on a rigorous way of doing business for experiments and try to do them all in one way, I think we're in for a lot of bitter disappointments and problems. We have to be able to react, and we have to be able to treat different kinds of experiment developers or principal investigators in different ways because their problems are different.
This is, of course, maybe very difficult, yeah? It would also require a number of people who follow up these things, who make the agreements in the first place and then see to it that they are being implemented.
We all have always assigned people in the program office. We had a limited number of people, but they followed this. Mm-hmm. And in launch operations, a man was assigned to one or more experiments to work with the experiment developer and the experiment responsible center throughout the life of the activity here.
But we had relatively few flights. If we, in the future, hopefully have one flight a week, then of course will be quite a problem.
I think we have a major management problem facing us in dealing with the experimenters and the development organizations.
You still see, though, kind of individual agreements, really experiments adapted. That was really your point.
Yes, I do.
Or more experimental adapted.
I don't think we're going to have a standardized way of dealing with experiments or experimentals. First of all, these organizations and people don't lend themselves readily to standardization. Mm-hmm. But I just feel that the problems are so different from one kind of experiment to another in terms of how much does it, well, you take an experiment where you just bring it down here and stuff it into a compartment that's been prepared for it and close the door. We don't need any contractual arrangement, we don't need any configuration management plans, we don't need anything except an agreement that the guy will send it down here with the appropriate paperwork and we stuff it in for him. And you can go from there to the Apollo telescope mount, which was an experiment or a group of experiments, which is very complex. And a lot of contractors and a lot of people, and therefore required a great deal of rigor. Mm-hmm. And when we first entered into negotiations with Marshall as to how we would work with the team coming down here for ATM, there was much weeping and wailing about the rigor that we required in terms of paper and check sheets and procedure writing and so forth. But the more our people worked together, the more they understood the requirements. And I believe if you talk to them today, they will say that was a good operation. I'll say it again, because I've said it many times. The guy you had, one Gene Cagle over there, was a great guy and really did a hell of a lot to make that work. But that experiment was entirely different than the one where you just bring it down in your suitcase.
Yeah. I'm afraid the more experiments will be in the ATM category, though, than in the first category.
Numerically, you'll have more in the first category.
I hope
now,
you're
the
right.
Volume
I
of work,
still don't
the
see.
Volume and value of the work, dollar value of the work,
mm-hmm.
will be weighted towards the more complex experiment. So it depends on how you
mm-hmm.
want to count it.
Yeah.
And you'll have a whole bunch right in the middle.
I even thought number-wise, there may not be too many in the real simple category. They
Gosh,
all
I
will
hope
be
there is.
A little bit more complicated than
oh, I hope
what you had.
I hope there's lots of them in the simple category, so the little man can get in.
Mm-hmm.
If the shuttle can't accommodate the little man, who has a simple experiment that just needs to be flown in orbit
mm-hmm.
for a few days or whatever,
yeah.
then we're missing
mm-hmm.
one of the fundamental reasons
mm-hmm.
for having it.
Yeah.
It's a transportation system.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't accommodate him in terms of putting his
mm-hmm.
load in our truck and taking it where he wants to go, then we've missed
mm-hmm.
one of the fundamental reasons for the shuttle.
Yeah. Of course, a number of experiments, and I hadn't thought of them along that line, but a number of them may be in that category where the experiment or the scientist himself goes up into orbit.
Mm-hmm.
You just give him a tool that he uses. You don't really have to know in detail how he uses
the
tool once it's in orbit.
Environmental control and power and some instrumentation.
So if that's the way you look at it, you may be right. There may be more in that category than I had initially seen.
Or even small experiments. Look at the spider experiment and the pocket mice and so forth. You build a little device which has maybe its own environmental control and instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
But yet all it requires of the spacecraft is storage space. Or maybe it requires power and fluid servicing or something.
And I'm sure they had some of that, some of the power inputs. They had to air conditioning it.
We had all.
Yeah. And they had to take some photos, I'm sure, so the astronauts were involved. And of course, as soon as that happens, as not the experimenter himself, but another astronaut is involved, you at least have to put it in the plans,
yes.
in the timelines, and immediately you are involved.
Oh,
and
yes.
for that reason, I put these things at least in the center category. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they are not of the ATM type, admittedly, but they are also not quite as simple as just carrying something up.
That's right.
And I am afraid most of them will be in that category. Maybe I agree with you, they are not completely of the ADM type.
Well,
we couldn't afford too many of those.
But it gets us back to the fundamental thought that the detail of documentation, the rigor of your contractual or other agreements, varies
mm-hmm.
based on the complexity of the interface between the experiment and
mm-hmm.
its owner and the flight crew, ground crew,
mm-hmm.
the people who are flying it for them. They're two different groups
yeah.
of people. And I feel that the rigor of the management systems necessary are dependent upon the complexity of the interface.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bob. First state that this is an interview with Gordon Harris, the public affairs officer at KSC.
At, very early in 1960, decision had been made to transfer the Von Braun organization to NASA. And Dr. Von Braun and I were in New York, where he was addressing the American Newspaper Publishers Association. Before the meeting, he and I were walking down one of the avenues of New York, and Werner began to talk to me about the need to develop some kind of a nationwide educational program to condition the American people to accept space as a part of their lives, as they had come to accept national defense, aircraft, transportation, and so on. So that the public would, in that kind of an environment, believing that space was very much a part of their way of life, necessarily accept the financial costs of supporting the space program, which Werner at that time estimated roughly at a percentage of the gross national product, around 1%, if I recall. It wasn't too ambitious a program. But he was very concerned that at that point in time, when the Soviets had a much greater booster capacity than we had, that the Russians would pull off some spectacular, so massive, that the public and the Congress would lose heart and say, well, they're so far ahead of us, why spend the billions to catch up? And instead, let's go about our business and just forget about this nonsense. And Werner was impressing on me the need to start thinking about how do you keep the people interested in space, but also to adjust them to accept it as part of their future forever number.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I was wearing two hats, working with both Army and NASA. And later, I went with the Department of Defense and the Defense Supply Agency and came back to the space program in 1963. Now, NASA has a rather different concept of public affairs, largely because the Space Act, which created the agency, charged NASA with informing the public about its progress, its failures, as well as its successes. So that we have a direct mandate in law that says you must tell the public what you're doing, good or bad. There is also in NASA this concept of functional management, so that the assistant administrator for public affairs, in effect, is responsible to the administrator for the total public affairs activities of the agency. To me, that seems to conflict with the normal responsibilities of the manager of a large field installation, such as Dr. Van Brown in Huntsville or Dr. Divas at Kennedy, who necessarily must be attuned to the public affairs relationships between his own organization, the press, and the community where he's operating. But we have this functional manager sitting in Washington who has a fairly large staff working for him, broadly responsible for NASA's national public affairs relationships. And then you have at the center level a public affairs chief responsible to the center director, who actually employs him, pays his salary, holds him accountable to operate a public affairs program, which somehow must mesh with what the guy in Washington wants to do, who doesn't control the dollars and doesn't control the jobs in the field. And I think that's been a problem historically throughout Apollo, to a lesser extent in Skylab, and it's even with us today. The headquarters, and I'm talking about Code F, the Assistant Administrator for Public Affairs, publishes an information plan and says, this is what we're going to do at a different given date and time in connection with the anniversary of Apollo 11. And at Kennedy, there will be a ceremony. He did not consult the center director to find out if he wanted a ceremony. He talked directly to the chief of public affairs at Kennedy, and the chief of public affairs said, yes, if there's going to be an agency-wide observance of Apollo 11, certainly we'll do something here. And from there on, the planning was largely directed by Washington, working with me, and it was my responsibility in turn to keep Dr. Divas informed, because the resources to carry out this ceremony at Kennedy were all Dr. Divas's resources, not somebody in Washington. So there were, when you operate in this kind of environment, there are problems, because at the best, you're trying to serve two masters who may not agree on what the objective of the exercise is. And you just try to negotiate between the two and come to, hopefully, a compromise. This was much more serious during Apollo. To give you a case in point, when the first Saturns were flown back in the early 60s, Dr. Van Brown started the practice of bringing down as a morale booster a plane load of people from the Marshall Space Flight Center, maybe two plane loads, to reward people for good work. I came in the picture in December 1963, and I began to broaden this out to invite people from the community, public officials who necessarily ought to know what was going on, and an activity as big as this was, it had a very heavy impact on the total economy of Central Florida. And during the balance of the unmanned tests of the Saturn vehicle, and during the Gemini program in 1965 and 66, we ran what amounted to a local guest program. We invited up to 500 or 600 people, the leaders of women's organizations, our teachers' associations, the clergy, professional people, bankers, industrialists, mostly from the Florida area. We asked our contractors to give us names of people they'd like to have invited, and we'd accommodate up to as many as 1,000 guests at a single Gemini launch. Took them to a place where they could see the launch, told them what was going to happen, they saw the launch, and they went away after getting rapporteur. The response uniformly was highly favorable. It seemed to give people a feeling of immediacy, that they were somehow suddenly part of the space program, and they were very excited about it and exhilarated, and they were really enthused. As we entered the operational phase of Apollo, NASA headquarters by this time had seen this little program going up on the local level, so they decided to take it over. And the minute they did, problems began to develop, because now the question was, who controls the invitation list? Is it the fellow at Kennedy where the action occurs, or is it the man in Washington? And gradually a compromise worked out, so that Washington put out some invitations, the Marshall Space Flight Center had some, the people in Houston had some, and Kennedy had quite a few. Kennedy had to draw upon its resources to support the operation. That will hire the fleet of buses, as many as almost 200 buses for Apollo 17, at a cost of like $150,000 for one launch. We had to call upon the other organizations in the center to take people out of their jobs and give them to me to train them as escorts to get on the buses and brief the guests and so on. We carried it off, I think, on balance pretty well. We handled as many as 12,000 guests, transported them in and out by buses, in addition to which we had other thousands of people who got passes which admitted their cars and all the occupants thereof. But there is still facing the public affairs man in the field, pardon me, this question of divided loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
He must be responsible to the man in Washington who is held accountable by the administrator. He must also satisfy his center director, who is the man to whom he had to look for the resources.
Yeah. Of course, in the new organization, really the whole NASA setup is made that way. Rocco will head up all the programs. Of course, he has some of the key resources. He has the bulk of the money. I don't know how they handle the center operation, because that's now the other part of the deal. And again, Rocco would always have to work pretty much the same way you just described how it worked in the PAO up to now. And in a way, really, the whole Apollo management system was based on that principle, yeah? So Sam Phillips had his management organization through Lee James and Arthur Rudolph prior to him, and these people, and they always had to keep the center directors brought up to date. Maybe one of the big differences in why it was it could be done successfully was, of course, also George Müller met regularly with Werner and Kurt Debus in the form of the management council. And they were automatically, all the time, being brought up to date. But maybe that's the type of thing that was missing in PAO.
If I drew a comparison between the way the Army ran its programs in the days of Redstone, Jupiter, Pershing, and so on, and NASA, the commander responsible for the program was responsible for all aspects of it, including public relations.
Mm-hmm.
There was never any question about who was calling the shots on those public affairs events related to those programs. It was the same military commander for whom were the groundwork, and necessarily then there was a close tie-in between what the public affairs guy did and what the technical line and the program management line did. In NASA, in manned spaceflight, at the Washington level, there is a man sitting there for public affairs, but he doesn't report to the director of manned spaceflight, he reports to the director of public affairs at another
building.
That's
a completely different line, and there's really no
co-location.
There is no feedback, yeah.
And Sam Phillips had very little part to play, very little influence to exert in the public relations aspects of Apollo, as did Patron when he succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Periodically, they'd be called upon to address a press conference or participate in a press briefing, but they didn't shape the program.
Mm-hmm.
It was shaped by another man, a public relations man, unfortunately, in some circumstances, who did not understand the hardware and did not understand the program requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you divorce the two, you don't get the same results at the end of the line.
Have you ever fed this kind of information back to headquarters?
Yes, I have talked it to Dr. Davis, and talked it to all the people I can talk to. Let me give you a for instance. It was decided long ago, and by other people I had no part in the decision, that when we were launching a manned space vehicle, at the time the vehicle cleared the tower in Saturn, it was the first 450 feet of flight. Once it cleared the tower, all the public affairs commentary about what was occurring in space came from Houston, 1,000 miles away. Had the rocket blown up in the first minute or so of flight while it was still within plain sight of the press people gathered here to cover the launch, and we had as many as 3,500 press people on the big Apollo launches, they would not get the information from the people at the scene. They would get it from a disembodied commentator 1,000 miles away in Houston. And I think that's about as stupid an arrangement as anybody could possibly devise. But it goes back to the same, and I may be unfair in saying it, but I think it's a purely parochial interest that the guy that trains the astronauts and prepares them for flight is the guy that controls every word about them while they're in space until they're back safe on Earth. And that makes no sense to me at all. That suggests to me that the agency is not an agency. It's a group of, as NASA was once called, semi-autonomous principalities. All of us either work for NASA, in which case we should be able to interpret NASA under any circumstance, or we just work for the Kurt Debuses and Chris Babs and the Dr. Reeses and some other people in Washington speak for the agency as a whole. NASA public affairs numerous times over the years. And I was reading the other day in one of the congressional reports testimony by Dr. Payne in 1971. He was asked to come to the Senate Space Committee to tell them, what are you doing to publicize space benefits? And he had a whole host of things. Told how many people NASA had reached the previous year through exhibits. Estimated 32 million people saw NASA exhibits. X number of people had presumably seen NASA TV clips, which they send out at the television stations. It added up to a very impressive total. At a cost to the agency of something like $7 or $8 million. They spent for public affairs that year. More recently, and within this year, Mr. Teague brought in a man from Rockwell and put him on his staff to go look directly at NASA public affairs and talk to the guys in Washington, talk to people like me and in Huntsville and in Houston. What are you doing? What should you be doing that you're not doing? And the committee came up with some recommendations which they gave to Dr. Fletcher. I said, for example, you ought to be doing more about space benefits. You ought to be doing more with space mobiles, reaching into the school. You ought to be doing more to publicize technology utilization. Tell people what is coming out of the technology, how it's being applied, and so on. We've not done enough of this. Technology utilization functions as a separate part of NASA. It's not part of public affairs. And to me, that is largely, use a crude word, it's salesmanship. You're selling something. You've got technology to sell. If that's not what public affairs is doing, then we ought to get out of the business. So I think there should be a marriage between TU and public affairs. I don't think the public affairs guy can run it because he doesn't understand the technology, but he isn't doing anything to sell it.
And it may be a difficult subject to sell. It's certainly not as easy to sell as a lunar landing, no. Yeah, because it's not as visible.
That's correct.
You have to use a lot of Fifth Avenue type techniques to really make it even understandable by the public.
Some of these technology advances are so abstruse that they only apply to a very small discipline, and you can't even explain it in words that the layman would understand. Yeah. I don't think we make do you remember Schomburg? All right. He didn't make speeches. He put on dog and pony shows. He called them that himself. And he would get up in front of an audience and only say a few words that you and I would consider the beginning of a speech. And then he'd start to demonstrate things. He'd have a glass beaker, and he'd pick up a piece of smokeless powder in a stick, stick it in the beaker, put on white gloves just like a magician, two stars, the whole universe, light a match, and show them that the powder would burn. It didn't prove anything, but it was very exciting, particularly if they're women. You know, that smokeless powder that's used in guns? And look at the man, he's standing there burning. He always had a gadget, something that they could pick up and feel. And I've been talking about that in NASA. where are some of these spinoffs that a speaker can take around, hold up in front of an audience, pass it around, let them look at it, let them pick it up and see it.
Yeah, that might be a really good approach. And also space mobiles, they really have been cut down. They have been cut down in size, and they were, in the beginning, even very limited area-wise. And that are even the areas where they are not as much needed.
Originally, the space mobile was conceived as a headquarters function, funded by the public affairs chief. He put out a contract, presently to the University of Oklahoma. Headquarters paid the total bill. Well, as his budget was cut, he began to cut back on space mobiles. And right now, Kurt Debus is paying for one of the space mobiles serving Florida and Georgia. The other one is paid for by the headquarters. So they are trying to decentralize that function and put it back in the center. I'm not sure that that's going to work, because I could conceive that some center director, let's say at Lewis, in a budget squeeze. I mean, how much is this thing costing me? $500,000 a year? No, cut it out. You can do it some other way.
And Lewis may have to cover a huge territory. There is nothing in Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota who cover those. And these people really need it more than many others.
That's right.
The people here in Florida, they don't need it quite
as much. Center directors are men of different personalities. Some are much more closely attuned to public affairs than others. Kurt Debus has never denied me anything. Not a dollar, not a man. On the other hand, he takes only a limited personal amount of participation. He doesn't like to go out and make speeches. He'll do it if if it's a really mandatory thing, but he prefers not to do it. He will sit for press interviews. But Kurt wants an active public affairs program. During Apollo, I was being financed to the tune of almost $2 million a year just for this summer. And most of the money went to support those big launches. Chris Martin.